Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, Galveston 89.5 FM, and Huntsville 91.7 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on dozens of radio stations in different US and European cities. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1174, I will air some of the remarks delivered at the Emergency Conference on Palestine held in Bogota, Colombia, July 15th and 16th, 2025, organized by the Hague Group on the Genocide in Gaza. I will air the testimony of Dr. Thaer Ahmad, Palestinian-American emergency physician from Chicago, who volunteered at Gaza hospitals during the genocide. He spoke about the devastation he observed in Gaza. I will also share the measures announced in the joint statement on the conclusion of that conference, where states announced unprecedented measures to halt the Gaza genocide. After that, I will air the remarks of Francesca Albanese, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, delivered at a press conference she held in Bogota, Colombia, while attending the Emergency Conference on Palestine, and some of the questions and answers, including her reaction to the U.S.-imposed sanctions against her. On July 15th and 16th, 2025, an emergency conference on Palestine organized by the Hague Group on the genocide in Gaza was held in Bogota, Colombia. A coalition of cross-regional states gathered at that conference agreed to 6 coordinated diplomatic, legal, and economic measures to restrain Israel's assault on the occupied Palestinian territories and defend international law at large. Jointly convened by the governments of Colombia and South Africa as co-chairs, the Emergency Conference of the Hague Group brought together 30 states from Africa, Asia, Europe, as well as North America and South America to move beyond words of condemnation and to take collective action grounded in international law. One of the speakers at the conference, Dr. Thaer Ahmad, Palestinian-American emergency physician from Chicago, who volunteered at Gaza hospitals during the genocide, spoke at the conference about the devastation he observed while working at various hospitals in Gaza last year. Let's listen to his testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak at this very important event. I'm a Palestinian-American ER doctor who has had the privilege of volunteering and working in Gaza since 2008, and most recently last year, as well as in Lebanon. I was there in 2024 at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis and Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir el-Balah. I have no intention of standing up here today and summarizing the statistics and the numbers that all of you are very familiar with. And I know that those numbers and statistics are an undercount and do not even begin to tell the story of what is happening in Gaza. There is so much to say. So much of what's happening is horrifying, agonizing, and truly unbearable. But my time is limited, and my words cannot express the totality of the devastation and the suffering. My hope is that I can convey to you a portion of the reality on the ground. The way life itself has come under attack, the degree to which the ability to survive in Gaza has been hindered and obstructed. I hope that it will prompt us to think more deeply about the implications and consequences of what's transpiring in Gaza in human terms. Because for as long as I have been alive as a Palestinian, the terms used to describe us as a people have always been dehumanizing and degrading. Let us first understand what is meant when we say starvation and water is being used as a weapon of war. Imagine if your child was one of the 10 children that was killed queuing for water in Deir el-Balah a few days ago. Would you accept the excuse that it was a technical error? Would you allow the world to move on without acknowledging the injustice that was inflicted on your child? 2 weeks ago, Dr. Ahmed Al-Farra in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, the director of the pediatric division of Nasser Hospital, the largest remaining hospital in Gaza, He said, I am running out of baby formula. I am beginning to ration baby formula. I have 6 premature infants here in this hospital. Imagine if you were one of the parents for those 6 premature babies. Let me tell you what happens when premature infants are deprived of what they need to live. Imagine you had to watch them struggle to hang on to life. Shallow and rapid breathing, sunken eyes, desperate cries of hunger, that every day that they don't get the formula that they need, those cries get weaker and weaker and weaker. What do we say to the two parents, to the parents of the 2 children that have already died? What do we say to them? What do we say about the trucks that had the baby formula that are sitting right outside of Gaza? Do we say, sorry, we tried everything that we could? I was supposed to enter Gaza June 19th, 3 weeks ago. And talking to my colleagues on the ground, they told me about the issue with respect to the baby formula. And in my bag, between my scrubs, the clothes that I wear when I'm treating patients, I had cans of baby formula. But I was denied entry. Access is this problem that exists within Gaza long before October 2023. The ability to bring in the medical equipment, the medicines, the supplies that we need. There was a blockade in place long before October 7th. And for the children that have miraculously survived this starvation, and I pray that they continue to survive, it's important for us to realize that as long as they are going hungry and malnourished, that every single day they are suffering irreversible consequences to their mental development, to their physical growth. Would any of us be willing to gamble with our child's future in this despicable way? Would any of us tolerate this? And I do want to mention the new Israeli-American aid mechanism known as GHF, where hungry Palestinians in hopes of finding food are met with bullets instead. I messaged a friend saying, please go to these sites. They're slaughterhouses. Do not go. And he said, you know, people know there's a chance that they could die, but they can't bear looking at their families in the tents, hungry. They don't want to just sit idly by and wait for the rest of the world to do something about this. But the bullets fired from GHF mercenaries are just the tip of the iceberg with respect to this problem, the militarization of aid, the idea that you can ghettoize Palestinians, forcibly displace them to the south where these aid sites are, and somebody in military fatigues can decide, are you worthy of food or not? Is your background checked out in a way that now your family can eat? When our Palestinian colleagues tell us that the healthcare system is being deliberately targeted, we have to understand it goes beyond the bombing and the raiding of Al Ahli Baptist Hospital, of European Gaza Hospital, of Ashifa, Al-Awda, Nasser, Aqsa, Kamal Adwan, and so on, and all of the hospitals that have seen Israeli military either strike them, raid them, or render them defunct. It's, yes, the physical infrastructure is being damaged and destroyed, but also pillars of the medical system are being assassinated. Dr. Marwan Sultan, returning after treating patients, one of 2 remaining cardiologists in the north of Gaza, murdered in his home. Dr. Ahmed Qandil, an experienced surgeon, would train all of the young surgeons who would serve the people of Gaza, assassinated and murdered. This was just in the last week. And yesterday, as I thought about how I would address this congregation, I realized that I had already forgotten some of the names of my colleagues who had been killed in the last 21 months. And I say that ashamed of myself. But that's how many healthcare workers have perished in the last 21 months at the hands of the Israeli military. One of those was Thabat Salim, a very young physician working in central Gaza who was taking care of the newborn babies in the newborn nursery. Thabat being killed is not just a personnel problem where you don't have somebody the next day to show up to the hospital. Thabat being killed means that tens and hundreds of babies will not get the care that they need to have the best chance at life. And then there are the doctors and nurses that are being abducted and held without charge. some losing their life after being tortured to death. Dr. Adnan Al-Bush is the perfect example of that. A famous surgeon in Gaza, orthopedic surgeon. Everybody knew who Dr. Adnan was. And his body was found in Ofar prison, naked after being beaten to death. No charge, no trial. Currently, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, a pediatrician in the north of Gaza, is being held without detention. I spoke to his family yesterday, as well as his lawyer. His lawyer told me his condition has deteriorated significantly and that he's still wearing the winter clothes that he was abducted in back in December of 2024, and that he had lost weight and was not getting any medications, and he was being denied access to a doctor. Dr. Hussam should be in the hospital right now taking care of patients. And if we get a ceasefire tomorrow, we need Dr. Hussam to be the first person leading the recovery and response. He's one of 100 or so medical physicians and nurses that are still being abducted. And so if all of the nurses and doctors who've been attacked or abducted or killed or injured are gone and not a part of the response, then what does the day after look like? What did Dr. Hussam do to deserve this sort of treatment? He stood by in the hospital, refusing to leave when there were babies on the ventilators, when there were babies in incubators. He watched his son be killed and had to bury his son in the compound of the hospital. This is what we mean when we say the healthcare system is being attacked. 360 degrees. Medicine, supplies are stuck on the outside of Gaza. The infrastructure is collapsing. Fuel is being denied so that the lights cannot be turned on in the middle of surgery. The surgeons and the pediatricians are being killed, attacked, or abducted. And the people who need these services are continued to be displaced and herded like sheep. Go to this area. This area is under evacuation. Go to that area. Take your entire family and hope you can find a place in the sand near the sea. I myself also saw first responders and paramedics be attacked. I treated first responders who were victims of what is known as a double tap. When a home is struck and then there is a response to help save any of the survivors, there is a second follow-up missile. They're prevented from doing their jobs of just rescuing or retrieving people. Ahmed and Yusuf, two paramedics who were dispatched to go and save Hind Rajab, the six-year-old who was bleeding to death in the car, who was begging, saying, please, I'm scared, someone come and get me. Ahmed and Yusuf hopped in their ambulance. They got the permissions that were needed. They got the clearances. And when they were less than 100 meters away from Hind, a missile hit their car, killing both of them. And Hind's voice began to fade away as she was speaking to the operator from the Palestinian Red Crescent. One of her last things that she said when the operator asked, Hind, why aren't you talking as much? She said, every time I speak, blood comes out of my mouth. And I don't want to get my clothes dirty. My mom doesn't want me to get my clothes dirty. Yesterday evening, the Arafat family in Jabalia sent a distress call to the world beneath the rubble of their home that had been destroyed. They said, we are still here, we're still alive. Please, someone come and save us. And the first responders, the civil defense, said that they are actively being prevented from them, from reaching them and saving them. What are they supposed to do beneath this rubble, knowing that no one will come and save them? Their last moments, suffocating to death, starving to death. How will we be able to look at ourselves in the mirror? And whether it's polio, or this week meningitis, or last year, the lack of antibiotics or anesthetics, it seems every week there's a new emergency that we have to focus on that we need to do something about. And so to me, if there is a ceasefire, and I hope that there is a ceasefire in the next couple of days, we have to understand that even if the suffocating siege is partially lifted, that the bureaucratic hurdles of figuring out what is and what isn't on a dual use list will remain in place unless we change the way we are able to function in Gaza, unless we change the way that we are able to support the Palestinians on the ground in Gaza. And I want to conclude with just a few cases that I was involved in that really capture the essence of life being under attack in Gaza. Yusuf was a 5-year-old boy who was in his home in Khan Yunis, asking his mom, Rawan, what they were going to be having for dinner. And in a sudden instant, their home had been hit by a missile. The building collapsed. The missile came through the 4th floor where Yusuf's uncle lived, then down to the 3rd floor where Yusuf lived. The ceiling collapsed. Yusuf was trapped beneath the rubble. When the first responders arrived, they searched and they found Rawan, his mom, and one of her sons. They had survived. But the search for Yusuf was still ongoing. Eventually, they pulled him out and they rushed him to Nasser Hospital, where his father, a doctor, was working. And the images of his mother were seen by the whole world, running around from floor to floor in Nasser Hospital, asking if anybody had seen a red-headed, curly-haired boy named Yusuf. Finally, one of the workers brought Yusuf's mother and dad to Yusuf. He had died. His father stood composed, he closed his eyes, and he consoled his wife and his son, who collapsed in grief. His younger brother was clinging to his father, even hitting him. I want Yusuf. I want to see him. He had never spent a day without his brother. And Rawan never saw Yusuf's body. They wanted her to remember him as the curly-haired red boy and not to see what had happened. And Yusuf's father stayed working at Nasser. He said, my job is not to mourn my child, it is to help the living. Maybe treating patients was his escape. Maybe it was his way of coping. But ultimately, the Israeli military surrounded Nasser Hospital, raided it, and arrested Yusuf's father, and he is still in custody. Mayar is a 5-year-old girl who lived in Gaza City. And as she was fleeing with her family of 6 from their home in Gaza City, a bomb had hit nearby. Mayar's 18-month-old brother, Ibrahim, was killed, and her 11-year-old sister was killed. Her father lost both of his legs. Mayar was hit in the knee, and her knee joint was shattered. And she was at Al Ahli Hospital, and her mother told me that as they were fleeing to the south, because Al Ahli became surrounded by the Israeli military, that they had to go through this checkpoint, strip naked, and give all of the money that they had left to the Israeli military, which was 300 shekels, the equivalent of $100. I met Mayar's family in Egypt, Mayar's mother and her sister. I brought them to the United States. I had the honor of being a medical escort and bringing them from Egypt to the United States to be treated in America. We landed in New Jersey, and I remember waiting in the terminal in New Jersey and buying Mayar and her sister some pizza. And they said, the pizza in America sucks. It's better in Gaza. But I remember when we were in the airport, the mother had told me that she had received good news. And I said, what happened? And she said that the bodies of her 2 children, the graves, had been found. And so now when she goes back to Gaza, she'll be able to visit the graves of her 2 children that did not survive. And so I'll conclude by saying that there is an attack on the past, the present, and the future of Palestinians. Our homes, our universities, our museums, our mosques, our churches. The present, we're seeing our healthcare workers, our journalists, our aid workers, our engineers, and our future. Our children are being dismembered, disfigured, disappeared, our fertility clinics being destroyed. And so, yes, accountability is necessary. It's urgently needed. But also support and solidarity for Palestinian institutions, making sure that Palestinian institutions survive this, that they continue to move forward. That's what's required of all of us as well. How do we make sure that the effort to erase Palestinians from the history books is unsuccessful? The current dreams of the children in Palestine can be described in these current words. And our mission should be to change how they describe their dreams. When a child is asked, what do you dream of? What do you want to happen? And he tells you, I want my mother to come back from heaven. Or when a child says, I hope that I can grow another leg. How do we make sure that they have a chance at life? How do we make sure that those dreams become dreams of prosperity and success in future? And so I thank everybody's efforts here today. And I communicate that message from all of the healthcare workers in Gaza and all of the friends and families who I've been able to communicate with. And I hope that the message of urgency is translated into action. And I hope that our statements can be followed by concrete steps and approaches. And I hope that this miserable nightmare comes to an end sooner rather than later. But to echo what was said earlier, that is when the work starts. That is when we have to put forward the new plan and the new world for the future generations. We cannot allow a precedent to be established. Today it is Palestinians and Palestine, but tomorrow it is all of us. Thank you.
That was Dr. Thair Ahmad, Palestinian-American emergency physician from Chicago, who volunteered at Gaza hospitals during the genocide, speaking at the emergency conference on Palestine held in Bogota, Colombia. In the deliberations at that Bogota conference, all 30 participating states unanimously agreed that the era of impunity must end and that international law must be enforced without fear or favor through immediate domestic policies and legislation, along with a unified call for an immediate ceasefire. Let's listen to the measures announced in the joint statement on the conclusion of that conference, where states announced unprecedented measures to halt the Gaza genocide, read by the Deputy Minister of Multilateral Affairs of Colombia, Mauricio Hasir.
We hereby announce the following measures to be adopted based on states' domestic legal and legislative frameworks. Number one, prevent the provision or transfer of arms, munitions, military fuel, related military equipment, and dual-use items to Israel as appropriate to ensure that our industry does not contribute the tools to enable or facilitate genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and other violations of international law. Prevent the transit, docking, and servicing of vessels at any port, if applicable, within our territorial jurisdiction while being fully compliant with applicable international law, including UN clause, in all cases where there is a clear risk of the vessel being used to carry arms, munitions, military fuel, related military equipment, and dual use items to Israel to ensure that our territorial waters and ports do not serve as conduits for activities that enable genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and other violations of international law. Number three, prevent the carriage of arms, munitions, military fuel, related military equipment, and dual use items to Israel on vessels bearing our flag while being fully compliant with applicable international law, including UN clause, ensuring full accountability, including deflagging for non-compliance with this prohibition, not to render aid or assistance in maintaining the situation created by Israel's illegal presence in the occupied Palestinian territory. Number four, commence an urgent review of all public contracts in order to prevent public institutions and public funds, where applicable, from supporting Israel's illegal occupation of the Palestinian territory, which may entrench its unlawful presence in the territory, to ensure that our nationals and companies and entities under our jurisdiction, as well as our authorities, do not act in any way that would entail recognition or provide aid or assistance in maintaining the situation created by Israel's illegal presence in the occupied Palestinian territory. Number five, comply with our obligations to ensure accountability for the most serious crimes under international law through robust, impartial, and independent investigations and prosecutions at national or international levels, in complete ensure justice for all victims and the prevention of future crimes. Support universal jurisdiction mandates as and where applicable in our legal constitutional frameworks and judiciaries to ensure justice for all victims and the prevention of future crimes in the occupied Palestinian territory. We emphasize that these measures constitute a collective commitment to defend the foundational principles of international law. In recognition of all the violations of the right to health, we call upon the UN Economic and Social Council to commission an immediate investigation of the health and nutritional needs of the population of Gaza, devise a plan to meet those needs on continuing and sustained basis, and report of these matters before the 8-0 session of the United Nations General Assembly. We appeal to all the United Nations member states to enforce our obligations while promoting mechanisms for cooperation between all parties. Adopted in Bogota, Colombia, this 16th July of 2025. Thank you.
That was Mauricio Hasir, Deputy Minister of Multilateral Affairs of Colombia, reading the measures announced in the joint statement on the conclusion of the emergency conference on Palestine. I have a link to the full statement posted on our website, arabvoices.net. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different U.S. and European cities. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Francesca Albanese, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, spoke at the Emergency Conference on Palestine held in Bogota, Colombia, and also held a press conference at which she addressed several questions by reporters, including her reaction to the U.S. sanctions imposed on her, after she released a report a couple of weeks ago titled From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. By the way, I had aired her remarks about that new report 2 weeks ago, and that is archived on our website, arabvoices.net. Let's listen to her speaking at that press conference and answering reporters' questions.
As you know, I'm here in Bogota to attend the Hague Group Emergency Ministerial Conference, where practical measures to end the genocide in Gaza are to be discussed and hopefully taken. This gathering holds the potential to be the beginning of a transformative political process. For too long, international law has been treated as optional, applied selectively on those perceived as weak and ignored by those acting as the powerful. This double standard has eroded the very foundation of the legal order. That era must end. The law must either be universal or it will cease to mean anything at all. No one can afford this selective approach. The conference this week can be a watershed moment. States have the opportunity to break the silence and revert to a path of legality by finally saying, enough. Enough impunity. Enough empty rhetoric. Enough exceptionalism. And enough complicity. The international legal order is at risk of unraveling under the weight of the atrocities witnessed over the past 21 months. The International Criminal Court prosecutor's application for arrest warrants remains outstanding, while the genocidal campaign in Gaza and ethnic cleansing in the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory continues. The provisional measure ordered by the International Court of Justice to prevent genocidal act and preserve evidence of crimes committed in Gaza remain unfulfilled. The groundbreaking ICJ advisory opinion declaring Israel's occupation unlawful and amounting to racial segregation and apartheid, followed by a widely supported General Assembly resolution giving a deadline for Israel to withdraw and dismantle the occupation, the settlements, and the exploitation of Palestinian natural resources, 17 September 2025, remains to be enforced. The UN Charter and universal human rights instruments must remain everyone's compass. I trust that most states will align their policy with these fundamental principles so that we can move forward at this existential moment for both the Palestinians and the Israeli people and the integrity of the international legal order itself. By the end of the conference, I truly hope that states will agree to some actions. Few actions is okay. Can be one, two concrete actions to lead to a meaningful change for the Palestinian people. The international community owes that to them. Lastly, I would like to address, and I'm available to take questions concerning the findings brought forward in my last report, which has exposed the economy of the occupation that Israel has set up and maintained over 57 years over what remains of historical Palestine, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, and which has turned into an economy of genocide. And thank you.
Good evening. This is Albanese. I wanted to ask you, how did you receive the news on the U.S. government sanctioning you for a job as a special rapporteur? And what's your response to that decision?
It's a very serious measure. It's unprecedented. And I take it very seriously. It's a clear violation of the convention on the UN Convention on Privileges and Immunities that protect UN officials, including independent experts, from words and actions taken in the exercise of their functions. This is something that could lead to the United States to face the ICJ if there were one member state bringing the case before the court. But look, I'm not asking for anything like that. I don't want member states to distract their attention from where it should be right now, ending the genocide in Gaza. This is what matters. And then ending the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, which is advancing at incredible speed. Look, the attacks, these attacks, these sanctions, and what has preceded shall not be seen necessarily as an attack directed against me personally. This is rather a warning to anyone who dares to defend international law and human rights, justice and freedom. And I think that in the face of this, we cannot afford to be silenced. And I know that I'm not alone. At the same time, let me say, I mean, I really feel and I'm very touched by the solidarity of the people who from all corners of the world tell me, we have behind you. What does it mean? Are you walking as an army of moral warriors behind me, or are you just hiding? Is expressing support toward me the best you can do to contribute to end this genocide, which has our fingerprints? So this is why I'm thanking everyone who's expressing solidarity and support. It's not about me. It's about the Palestinian people who are being genocided and erased from their land.
Dr. Albanese, after all the denouncing we saw this morning, what could be the next steps in terms of effective actions? That break silence you were talking about.
Yeah, I talk about breaking the silence because we are at this level. The international community has always engaged in rhetoric. There has been condemnation of the settlement expansion, condemnation of the extrajudicial killings, and imminent cases of arrest and detention and torture that over the years, over the decades, the other forms of collective punishment that have affected the Palestinians. Right now, we see that the impunity that the rhetoric that has remained rhetoric without followed by concrete action. We see that impunity now leading to the current reality, which is apocalyptic for the people in Gaza, but also the West Bank. Entire refugee camps have been raided. The entire Jordan Valley has been emptied of Palestinian life. There were thousands of communities living there. And settler violence continues. And silence has fallen on many members of the international community, particularly but not only from, I mean, the part of the world I come from. So first of all, they need to come back to senses and speak out. This is unacceptable. And this is not just a genocidal assault on the Palestinians that has the fingerprints of all of us. This is something that is really eroding the multilateral system we are part of. Then, of course, actions have to be taken. Sanctions must be imposed on Israel. And it comes as a shock to member states who for many years have entertained this argument that it's about the colonies and it's about boycotting or sanctioning the settlements and settlers' violence. I wish it had been done before. But now we need to understand what's happening. And what I revealed with my last report is that Israel as a state, its policies and its economic interests are completely and totally intertwined with that of the colonies. So this is why sanctions must be imposed on Israel. And of course, there should be also individual measures taken against the most extreme, Israeli leaders or others waiting for accountability. Because Israeli leaders and others who have committed crimes need to face justice, being at national level. There are many countries with universal jurisdiction, or at the International Criminal Court. So again, there are many, many things that need to be done. But concretely, I think that it's absolutely compulsory not to delay further an arms embargo. This is an international obligation. It's no charity. It's no act of solidarity, an arms embargo, and stop transferring other sources of energy that are powering Israeli crimes. And this is just to start with. The last thing, the last concrete measure that I've asked, this concerns primarily those states who have a port in the Mediterranean Sea. You need to send boats. You need to send not flotilla organized by individuals, which are commendable. But this doesn't take off the responsibility from member states. So it's about time that member states, which have a port in the Mediterranean Sea, set boat with doctors, nurses, and other expertise, foods and medicine, including baby formula that is needed for people not to starve. And then, of course, there would be a need to send a protective presence. But again, one at a time.
Thank you.
Hello. Regarding the European Union, why do you think there are not more European countries here to take action? And why do you think the European Union didn't break its agreement with Israel, given that it implies the respect for human rights?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask. To answer why they didn't do that. The fact that they didn't do that is appalling. And, because if that agreement was a disgrace the moment the European Union entered it, because Israel has committed war crimes and crimes against humanity for decades, since 1967, when the UN Security Council ordered Israel to withdraw the troops. Not only the troops were maintained and are still there, but colonies after colonies after colonies have been built. And now there are 400,000 Israelis who are under Israeli law. This is a war crime. And by the way, this war crime has tripled during the negotiation period, because there were about 80, 90 colonies until the 90s, and now there are 300. So while member states were residing, entertaining themselves with the mantra of the two states, and for the Palestinian, that agreement was a huge sacrifice. They have continued to support it. So, and then there have been crimes against humanity, like forced displacement and collective punishment against Gaza, multiple wars and multiple documented violations of international law. So this is why I'm saying that agreement should have never been entered. The fact that it's been renewed in the face of the total destruction of Gaza marks yet another, probably the lowest point of European Union foreign policy right now, the celebration of double standards, and also, frankly, the betrayal, the fatal betrayal of European values. I've said before, and I repeat, I think that the founding fathers and mothers of the European Union are turning themselves in their graves today.
Thank you.
Dr. Albanese, how can we, as part of the Global South, generate meaningful pressure in a world that has long overlooked us?
I think that the Global South, or Global Majority, as I prefer calling it, because the concept of the Global North really defies geography, I think the global majority has already taken steps, unprecedented steps, that the global minority has never considered. I hope they will own it. They have having South Africa initiating proceedings against Israel has done something historical, memorable, and has brought Israel before an international court for the first time in its own history. And this is a case that really deserves to receive further support and further participation by other member states, including from the global majority, because this is the first settler colonial genocide to ever be litigated before an international court, and the cry for justice is even louder. I hope they see that the leaders of the global majority, I hope they see that they are inspiring so many, including in the global minority, in the part of the world I come from. And there is a need for principled leadership. It's fantastic that it comes from here, from the place that has already once, through the decolonization era and through making the international law system more democratic and more reflective of a variety of human rights and needs. It's very powerful to see that they are engaging today as well to take concrete measure, concrete steps against an alliance, which is, because of course there is Israel, but there is the US behind Israel. So there is a lot that they are putting, they're taking risk, but I think this is just one step in the right direction, the first step in the right direction, because the system is breaking apart. We will never be able to get out of this genocide the same way we entered it. And if we don't give birth to something better than this, the future will be much, much grimmer and darker for all of us.
Thank you.
Ms. Albanese, how can this conference in Bogota work in order to really stop the genocide in Gaza? And are you expecting to meet personally with President Gustavo Petro?
Actually, I did meet with the president, so done. Look, one of the things that my last report revealed is that there is no one who has clean hands when it comes to Palestine. And this is not because of bad intentions of states. It's because of interconnectedness of the global world we are part of. And therefore, there are economic and financial ties that bring also the global majority, countries in the global majority, including South Africa and Colombia, Malaysia, into this. Now, if these member states decided to stop the provision of coal to Israel and other raw materials and resources, because this is something that comes primarily from the global majority, it would have such an impact. It doesn't take 30 member states. I mean, it can start with a small number of states doing the right thing. One, two actions. Declare an arms embargo. Don't provide further resources. Commit to support accountability, investigations. These are measures that can be taken. Look, truth doesn't require particular intelligence. Truth requires courage. And I truly hope that the member states who have joined the Hague group will uphold the mission that they have already showed to us.
I want to ask you, what measures are states being used to implement in terms of trade restrictions, and how viable are these given their existing commercial agreement with Israel?
I'm not able to answer this question yet, because this is going to be the subject of my next report. In my next report, due to the General Assembly in November this year, I want to examine what member states have done to comply with the ICJ advisory opinion of 2024, especially in light of the proceedings for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the genocide proceedings. So I know that so far measures have been important, but not such to produce the effect that is needed. So countries like Colombia or Canada, many other countries, there are so many countries that have free trade agreements with Israel, they must cut them, they must curtail them, they must seize them. There is no yes or no or adjustment to it. These are the measures that have to be imposed given the seriousness of the situation, and hopefully to be removed once the forever occupation will be dismantled together with the apartheid. And this will also be the era where genocides will be accounted for.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to ask again about the personal sanctions, but you opened up the possibility of a discussion at the ICJ on these sanctions. I wondered if you could expand a little bit of what you just said. And more in general, if you are worried that this type of retaliation on you personally could scare other multilateral institutions into moderating their criticism of Israel, or even open the door to self-censorship? Thank you.
Yeah, I will answer the second part of your question first. Look, the attacks against my mandate, although, as I said, I don't think it has anything to do with me as a person, have been intense and very, very fierce for many months right now. It's not something that started now. So these sanctions are the culmination of an harassment that is really unnecessary. But I would like to say that what happens to me is what happens to so many who stand for justice and accountability for human rights of all Israelis and Palestinians who live and call home the place comprised between the river and the sea. What again, I don't know, surely it will have a chilling effect. But what I see now is that this is not what's happening. In fact, the response has been global. There are so many member states who have spoken out, United Nations agency, and I've seen the response being as immediate as I would have never expected. So probably it's also, I also think that these measures, these sanctions, have somewhat crossed the line, and I hope that member states will find a way to keep on protecting me, because frankly it's not easy to continue doing what I'm doing, but I do because this is a mandate I deeply honor. I think it's necessary these days, given what the huge suffering and sacrifice that the Palestinians are taking upon themselves. But also because I think it's important to be an example that we cannot be silenced all. It doesn't matter. We will keep going. It won't be me. It will be someone else. And this is how we remain human. Concerning what I can say more, again, there is a provision in the 1946 Convention on Privileges and Immunities that makes the violation, its violations are sort of self-executing. There could be action taken domestically or before the International Court of Justice. So, for example, the General Assembly, it could be either state or the General Assembly referring the case to the International Court of Justice for an assessment of whether the United States violated my privileges and immunities, and which is pretty obvious. But again, I don't think that this is what we need right now.
Are you calling for that assessment?
No, because I'm calling for member states to impose sanctions, cut ties, economic, diplomatic, financial, military, strategic ties with Israel, and also make sure that any private actor or entity, being them arms manufacturers or companies producing goods and services or parts of the supply chains, banks, pension funds, and even universities and charities, stop being complicit with the crimes that Israel commits, because there are so many entities directly linked, contributing to and even causing human rights violations and even crimes. I mean, the 48 companies and entities I have mentioned in my report, they're just illustrative. They're not even the tip of the iceberg. They are illustrative of a system which must be dismantled. And so there is so much to do on this front that I don't want anyone to waste the precious time with other issues. History will prove who's been on the right side over the past, over the past months.
Following up on what you just said, do you think that under international law, the scale of U.S. support makes Washington a party to the genocide you've outlined? And if you could tell us what concrete action could come out of here that could make a difference. Thank you.
I think I've made a number of recommendations and comments on the concrete actions that must come out of these meetings, which means that the most important thing is that member states need to evaluate, to assess all the ties they have with Israel and cut them. There is nothing neutral. I mean, imagine of being in the 1990s in the face of the of apartheid South Africa, what would you ask to disengage from the Bantustan, the economy of the Bantustan, to impose sanctions on South Africa just for what it does in the Bantustan, or for what it has done to the non-white South African population? And this is the same thing. Besides the fact that, again, as I said, colonies do not exist on their own. Colonies are connected to Israel. Colonies absorb 10% of the housing needs of Israeli citizens. The water in Palestine, in the West Bank, is being used by Israel. There is one and one only grid. And this is the same water that has been curtailed from the Palestinians in Gaza. And so, you know, the partnership of the universities are not neutral, because even when they engage in the so-called agribusiness, the agribusiness is experimented also with Palestinian resources. So this is what member states need to know and to see. There are certain actions, because the focus of the meeting is the Gaza crisis. There are certain things that are necessary, and an arms embargo, including dual-use items, components, must be imposed. There is no way to slow down and then to stop the killing machine that Israel has put in place, other than stop arming it. Or there is no way to address the starvation and the total collapse of the health system without sending vessels with humanitarian aid. Guys, this is what makes us human. I mean, we can keep on talking, but eventually we need to ask ourselves, what would we want if we were there in Gaza or in the West Bank, etc. And again, I truly hope that member states will consider this. Sorry, there was a first part.
The other question was about the U.S., if the U.S.
I do believe that the U.S. is totally complicit with whatever Israel is doing, but to the point that with the new administration, even the forced displacement of the Palestinians, which has occurred for decades under the watch of everyone, including the United States, has become part of the U.S. foreign policy, while declaring that Gaza is a construction site, is to be turned into the Gaza Riviera, the Riviera of the Mediterranean Sea. And also the U.S. is clear, not only has provided weapons, is the first armed suppliers of Israel, followed by Germany, against which there is a pending case for genocide, by the way, but has also provided political support and is really engaging into mafia-style intimidation of so many who are trying to stop it. And this is why I keep on saying it's about also breaking the silence. Look, something that I've said before, there are 193 members of the international community, of the United Nations. It's about time that the other 191 realize that they have nothing to gain from the criminal endeavor, which is committing a genocide which has turned into a genocide in Gaza. And also this must be a wake-up call for all of us, besides member states, us, citizens of our own countries and of a global society. Those of us who do not control weapons, algorithms, and large wealth. What do we have to gain from it? Don't we see that this system is also experimenting with weapons and containment techniques over a defenseless population? Do we really believe that this is going to be limited to Palestine and the Middle East? Well, we are very naive in that case.
Thanks.
Hello, Ms. Francesca. I wanted to ask you, What does the news that you talked about coming from Brussels today, that the EU did not agree on sanctions against Israel, signal about the current landscape of international accountability? And how does it underscore the urgent need for a coordinated state action being discussed here by The Hague?
Yeah. Look, what I said remains valid. It's clear that the European Union, for whatever reasons, because of affinity with Israel, said its ideology, because of political convenience, or because of other interests, including that of the companies. I mean, Europe is a huge trade partner of Israel. So because of all these reasons, the European Union is putting the bare life of millions of people to the side. This is regrettable, but it also speaks to realities. First, that the European Union is being used as an excuse by member states to evade their international law obligations. Regional law, regional policies and regulation do not overtake international law. International law takes precedence. And so whatever the European Union decides, it's still an obligation. There's still an obligation upon individual states to prevent genocide and to ensure respect and, to respect and ensure respect of international humanitarian law. So they have an obligation to intervene. And a gathering like the Hague Group gives the possibility to act in solidarity, to act together, in order not to have to face, as individual states, the side effects of these stance on principles. The other element is that there are a number of member states who have taken steps toward greater accountability and respect for international law. For example, Spain, Ireland, Norway, to an extent, because I really have an issue with Norway's position on its pension fund, which contributes on its own on 70-80% on investment of 45 companies that I've investigated. But let's say politically, Norway has been on the side of Palestine, and it is to increase these the coherence of its commitment, and these are the countries that today, Norway is not part of the European Union, but these are the states that need to, despite what the European Union has decided, if they are coherent and with their obligations under international law, they have to act on their own. There is no way around it.
Is there like a need to recognize the Palestinian state before, like, is it important, you think?
Look, I think it should have happened 33 years ago. Right now, for me, this is not the priority. The fact that there is a conference soon to happen in New York, I know that many are working on it, but this is, again, it's another distraction. Because what we need to do, while member states, they don't need to have a conference to recognize the state of Palestine, like Ireland, Spain, and Norway have done. So the point is that member states tend to engage on anything that allows to buy time and not to deal with the real issue. How do we stop the slaughtering of civilians in Gaza? How do we stop the ethnic cleansing of Palestine? And the reality will turn uglier and uglier, and not the contrary.
That was Francesca Albanese, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, speaking and answering questions at a press conference she held in Bogota, Colombia, during the Emergency Conference on Palestine, organized by the Hague Group on July 16, 2025. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different U.S. and European cities. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.